Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, June 4th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Noelle Swan, reading for Ann Scott Tyson.
And I'm Noah Robertson.
Sometimes the most powerful messages are not shouted, but whispered. They are hinted at or even left unspoken, yet still conveyed. Hong Kongers proved this today. For 30 years, the city held the biggest annual commemoration for those who died in China's June 4, 1989, crackdown on pro-democracy protests centered in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. A huge candlelit vigil attended by thousands in Victoria Park, it marked the only large-scale Tiananmen memorial on Chinese soil. Over the past year, authorities have imposed harsh new measures, such as an anti-subversion law aimed at snuffing out such events and, it seems, public memories of Tiananmen in Hong Kong. They have jailed Hong Kong pro-democracy activists for attending earlier Tiananmen events, altered or censored textbooks and public broadcasts, and earlier this week closed a small museum dedicated to the movement. Yet in the face of thousands of patrolling police and a ban on the Victoria Park gathering, Hong Kongers found subtle ways to remember those who fought for political freedoms and perished on June 4, 1989. Hundreds flocked to churches for commemorative masses, promoted on posters with vague but nonetheless searing statements such as, "Let's not forget history." Scattered around the city, groups gathered, some wearing black, the traditional color of Hong Kong protesters. In Mong Kok and the shopping district of Causeway Bay, once locations of huge pro-democracy protests, scores of people beamed their cell phone lights and lit candles after dark. It's more or less in Hong Kong people's DNA now, lawyer and organizer Chow Hung Tung told the BBC earlier. "I am willing to pay the price for fighting for democracy," said Ms. Chow. She was arrested today in Hong Kong. Tiananmen activist Han Dongfang, who was almost killed in the Beijing crackdown 32 years ago, spoke of hope and light as he relaxed on a bench in Victoria Park today, despite the presence of dozens of police. Dressed in black, he told Reuters, "Today, I just feel like being here." Now, today's stories. Our first story. A tug of war over the teaching of American history and race is playing out in state legislatures. Given the chasm between views on either side, what is the best path forward?
A culture war is heating up just as students and teachers are starting to break for summer. Conservative politicians in 16 states have introduced legislation aimed at prohibiting the teaching of concepts they cite as divisive. They attribute these to critical race theory, a decades-old idea that considers the ways race and racism influence American politics, culture, and law. So far, laws have been passed in Arkansas, Idaho, Oklahoma, and Tennessee, with another one waiting Texas Governor Greg Abbott's signature. Those in favor of the new laws want more restrictions as classroom discussions and hastily implemented anti-racist lesson plans have taken hold in the past year. Those opposed say rules could have a chilling effect on conversation about racism and race in schools just when it is needed most. Jonathan Zimmerman, author of Who's America, puts it this way. "The debate isn't about whether there's been racism. It's about what racism has meant and what it's done to America. Is it something that's been progressively overcome as we move toward fulfilling our national ideals? Or is it something that's been a constant force in society, making society itself irredeemably racist? What we need is for each side to have the courage to let that debate happen in our classrooms." This story was reported by Chelsea Sheasley for The Monitor.
The discovery of the remains of more than 200 children at a former school in British Columbia could highlight Canada's abuse of Indigenous peoples the way George Floyd's killing did to police brutality against Black Americans.
The discovery of an unmarked grave holding the remains of more than 200 Indigenous children, including one possibly as young as age 3, has shaken Canada. The burial place was found using a ground-penetrating radar at the site of a former residential school in British Columbia. Residential schools were government-sponsored religious institutions intended to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into white culture. A network of 130 residential schools was established across the country beginning in the 1870s, and the last one didn't close its doors until the mid-1990s. The schools were rife with physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded that Canada committed, quote, cultural genocide in removing 150,000 Indigenous children from their homes. So far, 4,100 children are known to have died in the schools. But even if the statistics have been known, the current discovery has still been devastating. Angela White, the executive director of the Indian Residential School Survivor Society in British Columbia, says, "We are a country that's supposed to be the leader in human rights, equality, and justice for all, and embracing diversity to the point where that's our motto. And in one fell swoop, that perception was shattered to the core." This story was reported by Sarah Miller-Yana in Toronto for The Monitor.
Peru's polarizing presidential election is calling up violent memories of the past, despite nearly two decades of peace and reconciliation. Overcoming these divides is key to putting the nation on a positive path forward.
Peru's presidential runoff is kicking up dust of its bloody, not-so-distant past as a right-wing candidate faces off against a far-left politician. On the table are the very issues that have torn Peru apart since the 1980s. Terrorism, corruption, inequality, supercharged by a pandemic that has battered the economy and sharply increased poverty. But the left-right divisions played up during the campaign that a leftist-like former teacher Pedro Castillo will put Peru on a path like Venezuela's, or that Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of a now-imprisoned former president, will lead Peru with an autocratic hand, have overpowered actual policy proposals. What concerns me is that people could come to the conclusion that things won't change with elections, says Giovanna Peñaflor Guerra, a political analyst. If the country cannot move on quickly from the bruising election, with the losing party promptly acknowledging the victor, observers say Peru's challenges could deepen, with possible repeats of the drama of the past few years: presidential impeachments, shuttered legislatures, and instability. The polarization is so extreme that people will end up voting for the candidate who scares them less. It could create even more instability, says Luis Benavente, executive director of a Lima polling firm. This story was reported by Lucien Chauvin in Lima, Peru, for The Monitor.
Being housed can be far from being at home. In Boston, a new aid program recognizes the vulnerability of so-called doubled-up parents and children, a couch-surfing homeless population traditionally overlooked by subsidized housing programs.
When a parent runs out of money for rent, it's their social capital they often spend to stay off the streets, asking to couch-surf with a relative or acquaintance willing to open doors, clear out a bedroom, put up with extra kids, and violate lease terms and occupancy codes. It's called doubling up. And 7-year-old Kristen was part of that population most of her life until her mom, Taylor Lopez, was placed in a subsidized apartment of her own last January through a new Boston aid effort recognizing and serving couch-surfing homeless families. Doubled-up families account for 3/4 of the more than 1 million homeless students in U.S. public schools, according to federal government data. And while this growing population is recognized as homeless by the U.S. Department of Education and Health and Human Services, the agency that funds housing assistance, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, does not consider them homeless. The Boston program, launched when the pandemic forced shelters to reduce occupancy, has housed 300 families, using public schools to connect doubled-up families to housing agencies with vouchers. Minneapolis and Chicago have created similar collaborations. Such programs are critical and long overdue, says Barbara Duffield, executive director of Schoolhouse Connection. It's a model that should be replicated across the country, she says. This story was reported by Jingnang Peng in Boston for the Monitor.
Are tradition and modernity always at odds? For the artisans of Venice, adherence to centuries-old guild specifications is paramount. But these glass blowers, bookbinders, and shipbuilders constantly seek to improve their crafts as well.
Subtle, yet significant. Those are the ways to describe the innovations pursued over the centuries by Venice's glassblowers, bookbinders, and shipbuilders, whose old-world attention to detail and use of quality materials still resonate today. In fact, the constant pursuit of innovation is a bit of tradition itself. It's how, in 1574, workers at the Arsenal shipyard assembled a galley in an hour, complete with ropes, sails, oars, and armament, with an assembly line process that predated Henry Ford's by more than 300 years. You can find Vedas Hajian's full photo essay in today's issue.
Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on helping would-be migrants stay put. Since 2015, when more than 200,000 people crossed the Mediterranean Sea monthly from North Africa in search of work and safe harbor from conflict, it not only altered the politics in Europe, but it also pushed the European Union to spend roughly $550 million in Libya to help stem the human flow. But containment measures do not tell the full story of what is happening in Libya and why it matters to U.S. and European efforts to end illegal immigration. A new study of migrants in Misurata, Libya's third largest port, offers timely insights into the motivations and solutions for human flight. The findings are more intuitive than surprising. Economic and security stability in Misurata increased its need for migrant labor and decreased the need for those laborers to move onward to, for instance, Europe. The study confirms the better intentions of the United States and EU to stabilize both the sources of illegal immigration and the countries whose economies are dependent on legal migrant labor. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great weekend. On Monday, we'll have a story from Jerusalem on the unlikely coalition that agreed on one thing. After 12 years under Benjamin Netanyahu, it is time for someone else to lead Israel. Finally, a quick correction from Thursday's article about the Sewing Machine Project. Comments originally attributed to Zaman International were in fact from Gigi Salka, director of Zaman's Boost training program. In today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective, a poem highlights how God's gift of grace is here to heal, bless, and uplift. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Erica Page.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.